I want you to imagine for a second that you're just, you know, sitting at home, maybe having your morning coffee, and your phone starts ringing.
Right, just a totally normal morning.
Exactly. You glance down at the screen, and the caller ID perfectly matches the customer service number printed right there on the back of your bank card.
Which immediately disarms you. I mean, it says it's your bank.
Yeah, so you answer,
mm-hmm.
and the voice on the other end is so professional. They're calm, they're reassuring, they know your name, they have your home address on file, and they even know the exact amounts of the last three transactions you made at the grocery store.
So it feels completely legitimate. I mean, you feel perfectly safe following whatever instructions they give you?
Completely safe. But that exact scenario is actually the opening move of a devastating, highly orchestrated scam. Today, we're diving into a fascinating investigative document titled Manufactured Trust: How iSpoof Industrialized Bank Impersonation Fraud.
It's a really eye-opening raid.
It really is. Our mission for this deep dive is to explore how a fundamental vulnerability in something as basic as caller ID birthed a massive multi-million dollar fraud as a service industry. We're going to look at how these criminal supply chains operate on a truly industrial scale.
And most importantly, we're going to talk about how you can actually protect your own finances from this.
Exactly. Okay, let's unpack this right now. To start, how did a platform like iSpoof managed to cause so much devastation in the first place?
Well, to really understand that, we have to look at the foundational flaw they exploited. Because it isn't, you know, some highly sophisticated hack of the global banking system.
Right, it's not like they're breaking through firewalls.
Exactly. The core weakness is actually our societal assumption about caller ID. I mean, calling line information was never actually designed to be a strong cryptographic proof of identity.
Wait, really?
No, not at all. When telecrypt protocols were being built decades ago, caller ID was created purely for convenience. It was meant to support basic functions, like displaying a main business switchboard number when someone from a large office building calls you, rather than the specific desk extension they're dialing from.
Oh, I see. But we treat it like a digital fingerprint today.
Yeah, we totally do.
It's really more like, well, think of those "hello, my name is" stickers you get at a networking conference.
Well, that's a great way to put it.
Right. Literally, anyone can grab a Sharpie, write "the bank" on a sticker, slap it on their shirt, and we just blindly trust it without ever asking to see a driver's license.
That is exactly what's happening. And the scammers reinforce that metaphorical sticker with fragmented data. So they might have grabbed your recent transactions, your address, or your phone number from a phishing email, or maybe a dark web data breach.
Or even just scraping public social media profiles, right?
Yep, exactly. Knowing your home address doesn't actually prove they are your bank. It just proves they've assembled enough surrounding context to make their impersonation highly persuasive.
So the real vulnerability isn't just the fake number on the screen.
No, it's the caller ID fallacy. It's our ingrained assumption that the screen authenticates the actual human speaking to us.
And this is where the iSpoof platform enters the picture and just completely fundamentally alters the landscape. They took this simple technological vulnerability and basically commercialized it.
They really did. They turned telephone impersonation into a seamless monthly subscription service.
I mean, before platforms like iSpoof existed, a fraud group wanting to run a complex international spoofing scam had to build their own telecom infrastructure, right?
Oh, absolutely. They had to understand routing protocols, lease servers. I mean, they basically had to be legitimate tech experts.
But iSpoof removed that barrier to entry entirely. They made identity deception plug and play.
What's fascinating here is that criminal users could simply pay a subscription fee in cryptocurrency and instantly gain access to this entire suite of enterprise-grade tools.
Just like buying a Netflix subscription, but for crime.
Pretty much. Yeah. They could conceal their real phone numbers and push out numbers associated with major banks, tax authorities, or government agencies.
But they didn't just alter caller ID, did they?
No. iSpoof offered way more than that. They provided automated voice systems, PIN capture functions, live call monitoring. They essentially acted as an outsourced IT department for a fraud operation.
So they handled all the complex back-end engineering, meaning the criminals could focus entirely on the social engineering side of things.
Exactly. And because that technical friction was gone, it allowed criminals to scale up from being, you know, isolated small-time operators into an unimaginable industrial enterprise.
Yeah, let's talk about that scale, because when you look at the raw numbers in the source document, it is just wild. We aren't talking about a boiler room of 10 guys making calls.
Not at all. At its peak, this single platform had approximately 59,000 registered users.
59,000. And in just a one-year period, investigators estimated that 10 million fraudulent calls were pushed through the iSpoof network.
It's just a staggering volume.
There were periods where an astonishing 20 potential victims per minute were being contacted.
And the financial toll of that kind of volume is just catastrophic. UK investigators linked iSpoof-enabled activity to about £43 million in domestic losses alone.
Wow. And globally.
Worldwide losses were estimated to be well over 100 million. Action Fraud recorded 4,785 victims reporting incidents, and the average reported loss was around £10,000.
£10,000. That is life-changing money for most people.
It really is. And in one particularly tragic instance, a single victim was manipulated into transferring £3 million.
Oh, my God. £3 million.
Yeah. And when law enforcement eventually breached the platform's data, they found about 70,000 UK telephone numbers just sitting on the servers, representing individuals who were either actively targeted or compromised.
Okay, but wait, I have to push back on something here. You said 20 victims a minute earlier. How is that even physically possible?
I know it sounds impossible.
I mean, even a massive call center of thousands of scammers would struggle to manually dial, wait for an answer, and interact with that many people that fast. It just sounds impossible for a human workforce to manage.
Right, and that's the thing. The service aspect of fraud as a service relied heavily on automation. The criminals were almost never manually dialing those numbers.
Oh, so they were using software to prospect for targets.
Exactly. The iSpoof platform used automated scripts to rapid-fire dial thousands of phone numbers simultaneously. The sole purpose of this initial wave was to identify which numbers were active and which targets were actually likely to pick up an unfamiliar call.
So he just filters out the dead numbers and the people who send unknown callers straight to voicemail.
Yep. Then the platform reproduces what the telecommunications industry calls a genuine contact center journey.
What does that look like for the person answering?
Well, when you answer the phone, you don't hear a breathing human being right away. You hear a professional, high-quality, automated voice response system. It might even play hold music.
Oh, wow. So it sounds incredibly official.
Very official. And then a robotic voice says, you know, press 1 if you did not authorize a recent transaction of $500.
And once you press 1,
the automated system instructs you to enter your PIN on or security code on your keypad to verify your identity.
So the victim enters their PIN into the automated system, completely thinking they're just navigating a standard banking menu.
Right. And only then do they get transferred to the live human fraudster. But by the time that person picks up the line, they already see the captured keypad data right there on their screen.
That is so deeply manipulative. The automation didn't just dial the numbers efficiently. It set the entire psychological stage.
It absolutely did.
Going through an automated menu forces your brain to categorize the call as an official corporate interaction. It completely primes the victim for the human manipulation that's about to follow.
And that human manipulation is rigidly scripted and highly effective. The attack usually begins with an alleged severe security incident.
Like what?
The caller informs you that suspicious transactions have been detected, your account has been breached, or, and this is one of their most effective narratives, they claim a corrupt employee inside your local bank branch is actually the one siphoning your money.
Oh, wow. That specific script isolates the victim completely. It forces them to think they can't even trust the physical bank branch down the street.
Exactly. It makes them believe their only ally is this quote-unquote special fraud team member who is currently on the phone with them.
It creates this artificial, suffocating sense of urgency. The whole goal is to keep you in a state of sheer panic so you never just pause, hang up, and independently verify the situation.
Yes, panic is their primary weapon.
Now, here's where it gets really interesting in the source document. It makes a crucial distinction regarding the mechanics of how the theft actually occurs. Authorized versus unauthorized fraud.
Right. That's a very important distinction. Unauthorized fraud happens when the scammer takes the credentials they just captured through that automated menu, logs into your account themselves, and drains the funds.
So the victim's involvement ends at handing over the password.
Precisely. But authorized push payment fraud, or APP fraud, is entirely different. This is where the victim is psychologically manipulated into personally logging in and instructing the transfer of their own money.
To a supposedly safe account.
Exactly. They genuinely believe they are speaking to a security official protecting their life savings, so they willingly hit send.
And the fraudsters will actually stay on the line listening while the victim navigates their online banking app, or even while they physically walk into a local bank branch.
Yeah, they actively coach the victims.
They coach them on how to bypass the bank's automated warning screens, and they provide specific lies to tell the tellers to ensure the transfer gets approved. Like, they might tell the victim to say they're buying a used car or helping a family member.
Just specifically to evade the teller's fraud detection questions. If we connect this to the bigger picture, this illustrates a massive dilemma for financial institutions regarding informed intent.
House.
Well, from the bank's technical perspective, the genuine customer logged in from their usual IP address, entered the correct password, passed the two-factor authentication, and clicked approve.
So the transaction is technically fully authorized?
Technically, yes. But philosophically, the customer is making that choice inside a completely fictional narrative controlled entirely by a criminal. The customer fundamentally does not understand the reality of the transaction they're executing.
So the bank's security system is looking at the keystrokes and thinking, okay, this is the authorized user, entirely missing the fact that the user essentially has a psychological gun to their head.
That's a perfect way to describe it. They're making a fully authenticated choice based on a complete illusion.
And with funds instantly vanishing into digital accounts, local police are basically powerless to reverse the transaction. Once you hit send, the money moves into a completely different, specialized layer of the criminal supply chain.
Right, because the fraud operation certainly doesn't end when the victim transfers the money.
Where does it go?
The stolen funds immediately land in what investigators call mule accounts. These are often just everyday checking accounts belonging to ordinary people who have been recruited into the network, sometimes unwittingly.
Wait, unwittingly? How do you unwittingly become a money mule?
Well, criminals post fake job listings on social media or job boards. They advertise roles like regional payment processing coordinator or work from home financial agent.
Ah, so a college student might apply, thinking they landed a legitimate remote job.
Exactly. Their job is just to receive a wire transfer, keep a 5% commission as their salary, and immediately forward the rest of the funds to another account or convert it to cryptocurrency.
Oh, man. So they are acting as the getaway drivers for an international fraud syndicate, often without even realizing the severity of their actions.
Yep. And the entire system relies on velocity. The funds are transferred onward within minutes of the victim hitting send.
They're rapidly fractured, divided across dozens of mule accounts, withdrawn as physical cash at ATMs, or converted into crypto like Bitcoin.
Which creates this complex financial maze that totally evades the bank's ability to recall the wire transfer.
And it completely separates the masterminds running the ICE spoof software from the original crime scene. I mean, you can't just chase the money once it's in the mule network. You basically have to hack the infrastructure itself.
Which is exactly what law enforcement had to do with Operation Elaborate.
Right. Let's talk about that. Yeah. That was the massive takedown, wasn't it?
It was. Operation Elaborate was spearheaded by the Metropolitan Police in the UK, coordinating with law enforcement agencies worldwide.
Because the infrastructure and the users were scattered everywhere.
Exactly. Across so many international jurisdictions that it required a globally synchronized response. They infiltrated the servers directly. They mapped the cryptocurrency payment trails that the criminals were using to pay for their monthly ICE spoof subscriptions.
And they finally brought the entire platform down in November of 2022.
The initial takedown resulted in 142 arrests. Europol later reported that the dragnet swelled to 184 suspects across 17 different countries.
Wow. And they traced back that estimated $115 million in total global losses. But crucially, they managed to capture the actual architect of the platform, right?
Yes, TJ Fletcher. He was identified as the principal administrator of iSpoof, and he pleaded guilty to several charges. In May 2023, he was sentenced to over 13 years in prison.
Over 13 years. So what does this all mean? Did cutting off the head of the snake actually stop the problem, or did we just create a vacuum?
Well, the seized infrastructure did provide investigators with an absolute goldmine of intelligence user records, Bitcoin wallet addresses, victim data.
Which allowed them to track down the individual criminals subscribing to the site, rather than just arresting the creator.
Right. However, the disappearance of a single platform does not eliminate the underlying massive demand for these spoofing and impersonation services.
Yeah, it's like cutting off a hydra's head, isn't it? You shut down the servers and put the founder in prison, but the actual asset, the thousands of trained fraudsters and the open source code concepts, just migrates to a new domain name overnight.
Exactly. The source material highlights a successor platform called Russian Comms that stepped right in to fill the void left by iSpoof.
And the disruption of Russian Comms years later revealed that the business model remained incredibly lucrative. I mean, that specific platform allegedly enabled over 1.3 million calls to UK numbers between 2021 and 2024.
Causing tens of millions of pounds in fresh losses, we are dealing with an endlessly regenerating threat, and now artificial intelligence is entering the arena.
Oh, right, making voice imitation and automated scripts virtually indistinguishable from real humans. So what is actually being done to stop this?
Recognizing that taking down individual websites isn't enough, authorities are trying to build a resilient consumer control stack from the top down. Starting upstream, the focus is on the telecommunications infrastructure.
Like telecom filters.
Yes. Ofcom, the UK communications regulator, issued updated guidance for 2026. This sets strict expectations for telecom providers to identify and outright block international calls that falsely display UK mobile numbers.
Which is huge, because if the telecom provider can identify the spoofing at the network level and drop the call before it ever reaches your device, the bank never has to deal with a manipulated customer in the first place.
Exactly. But telecom filters can't catch everything, especially as criminals pivot to internet-based calling protocols or compromise domestic networks directly.
So the next layer of defense has to happen inside the financial institutions themselves.
Right. Banks are realizing they can no longer just look at the final technical authorization of a transfer. They have to monitor the entire sequence of customer behavior leading up to it.
They're looking for the digital fingerprints of panic, basically.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. If a bank's security algorithm sees a customer suddenly reset their password, immediately register a brand new mobile device, add a new pay they've never interacted with before, and then attempt a high-value transfer all within a 20-minute window, that sequence is a massive red flag.
The document also stresses that frontline bank employees must have the authority to apply what they call proportionate friction.
Yes. If a customer walks into a branch looking visibly terrified, appears to be reading from a script on their phone, or aggressively refuses to speak to the teller in private,
the bank employee needs the mandate to hit the pause button and halt the transfer.
Absolutely. And at the regulatory level, there have been major structural shifts to protect consumers. Since October 2024, regulations provide eligible UK victims of these authorized push payment scams with mandatory reimbursement protection.
Up to £85,000 for transfers sent through instantaneous domestic networks, right?
Correct. It ensures that if you are manipulated into one of these complex traps, you aren't left entirely destitute.
Which is great for the victims.
It is a vital financial safeguard for the public. But this raises an important question.
What's that?
Mandatory reimbursement fundamentally changes the incentives for the banks to improve their upstream security, acting primarily as a harm reduction mechanism.
Ah, I see.
Reimbursing the victim from a collective pool of funds doesn't strip the criminal network of their capability to launch the next attack tomorrow.
And it doesn't retrieve the stolen capital from the crypto wallets of the mule network. The criminal enterprise still walks away fully funded.
Exactly. Which means the ultimate unbreakable layer of defense has to be you, the listener.
Yes. The source document outlines a very clear, non-negotiable golden rule for personal defense: independent reconnection.
It is the single strongest control you have over your own money.
Independent reconnection means that an unexpected caller should never, under any circumstances, be the one to determine how you verify their identity. If you pick up the phone and it's someone claiming to be your bank warning you about fraud, your immediate reflexive response should be to hang up.
Do not trust the caller ID display. Do not hit redial on the number that just called you. You must sever the communication channel entirely.
You find the official customer service number printed on the back of your physical bank card, or you log into your verified banking app and you initiate the contact yourself.
You take absolute control of the narrative. No legitimate financial institution and no law enforcement officer will ever ask you to move your money to a safe account.
That concept just does not exist in legitimate banking.
No, it doesn't. They will never ask you to conceal a transaction from branch staff or recruit you to help with a secret internal investigation. If anyone asks you to do those things, it is a scam.
And if you realize you have disclosed your credentials or sent money, you must contact your bank immediately. Speed is everything. Rapid reporting is the only window the bank has to freeze the recipient mule account before the funds are dispersed into untraceable crypto networks. Wrapping up this deep dive, I think the most profound takeaway is realizing what iSpoof actually built. Technically, they sold caller ID spoofing and automated phone menus. But the true product they were manufacturing and distributing on a global scale was trust.
They industrialized the psychological ability to make you believe a lie.
Yeah.
And, you know, the source text forces us to confront a reality that is honestly quite profound. The criminals' entire operational success relied entirely on exploiting the implicit trust we naturally place in convenient technological identifiers.
We trust the caller ID, we trust the automated text message, we trust the professional-sounding robot voice.
Right. And as artificial intelligence and spoofing technologies continue to evolve, becoming indistinguishable from reality, we have to ask ourselves, are we rapidly approaching a society where we must adopt a strict zero-trust baseline for all digital and telephonic communication?
That is a terrifying but very necessary thought. What happens to the daily fabric of our lives, our businesses, and our social contracts when you literally cannot believe your own eyes and ears unless you are the one who initiated the contact?
It's a question we're all going to have to answer very soon.
We really are. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Stay curious, question everything, and most importantly, stay safe out there.